Good afternoon and welcome to Lambda Weekly. I'm Dave Taffet here in the studio with Laron Landis and the late Patty Fink. And our guest today, direct from the Texas Democratic Convention, is former representative and Tea Party organizer Glenn Maxey. Hi, Glenn. Welcome.
Welcome.
Welcome back. It's been a while.
And I appreciate the Tea Party organizer introduction, but just understand that I typically have great hors d'oeuvres at my tea parties, and everybody's pretty calm and collected and sane.
And they can spell?
They can spell, too, at my tea parties.
Yeah, I just wanted a different introduction, Patty. Patty was looking at what I had written down, and she was horrified. But, you know, you've never been introduced that way before, have you?
No.
Okay, so you see?
Yeah, a first.
You see? Everybody can introduce him as a former state representative, as the first openly gay representative, unless you want to... Were you in the legislature before Rick Perry, or...?
I came to work as a legislative aide the same session that Rick Perry came.
Okay, so he really was... Well, but openly gay is the problem. We'll talk about that later. openly gay, openly alcoholic, the two are the same thing, aren't they?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, okay. Second, executive director of Equality Texas.
Equality Texas actually is having its 25th anniversary as Equality Texas. Prior to that, it was a lesbian gay rights lobby, and I was the first executive director of it. In our LGBT history, there was no statewide organization other than the Dallas Gay Alliance at the time and Houston Gay Political Caucus and the Austin Lesbian Gay Political Caucus and the Alamo Human Rights Campaign. Those four groups were individual city organizations. And back in the late 80s, we had our first fight at the state legislature over whether there could be a queer group at Texas A&M. And that's when Betty Naylor, our great shero, was hired to sort of monitor legislation. The founding of the Lesbian Gay Rights Lobby happened in the mid-80s when there was a call for AIDS quarantine. And I was working for Senator Oscar Mazzi from here in Dallas, who represented Oaklawn. But I was living in Austin and but working for him. And people from Oaklawn were calling the senator's office saying, can the senator do anything about this quarantine? It was really fearful because quarantine in Texas meant being locked up until you were no longer infectious, and we didn't even know what caused HIV. And the people who could make that call were the public health authorities in each county, which were the county sheriffs. And so let's just say gay people were just a little freaked. And so I went to the senator and I said, Senator Mazzi, all of these gay people from Dallas are calling, saying, what can we do to help on this quarantine? And he said, what should we do? And I said, well, we need to go organize at the health department for the hearing. And he pulled his glasses down on the end of his nose, lifted his scotch glass. He was a heavy drinker at the time. And told me, when somebody ought to do something, that somebody would be you. I had no clue. I was in the closet, wasn't out as a gay man. So I actually went to a gay bar, picked up a copy of Twit magazine, opened it to the back page, and called the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force. Talked to its executive director, and I said, what do I do? And he said, you ought to call Dr. Mathilde Krim. Never heard of her, of course. He said, she's at Sloan Kettering, and she's the lead AIDS researcher in the nation. Keep in mind, I'm just a young kid doing this. And so I call, the woman answers the phone. I said, I've got this crisis. I don't know if the doctor would come down and testify. And she said, I'll be on the first plane. Then I realized I was talking to Mathilde Krim.
Oh, wow.
So she came down, and I found about 10 people to come testify at the Board of Health. And they were great people. There was somebody from the ACLU. There was a Catholic priest. There was a Baptist minister. There were lawyers. There were, you know, all the kind of people you'd expect to testify on an AIDS quarantine. They were all gay, but none of them were out. Everybody was a closet case. There was only one openly gay person who spoke at that hearing. That was Toby Johnson, from San Antonio as a psychologist and came and talked about the homophobia around this issue. So when the hearing adjourned, the Board of Health had postponed this, tabled it. It was a great victory, and we walked out into the hallway, and there's a bank of TV cameras. And those TV cameras were all rolling, and they wanted to know who was in charge. Of course, there was no gay rights organization. There were no AIDS organizations. There was nobody in charge. And, of course, my closeted professionals all were going like, oh, hell no. No way I'm getting in front of that camera. I just came to help this, but I'm in the closet. So I stepped up as a legislative aide to a state senator and said, talked about what had just happened. And I rushed home that evening to sit in front of my TV. Well, I didn't really sit. I stood up several times to change the channels because we didn't even have channel changers back then. And I landed on the CBS Evening News with Dan Rather. And Dan Rather was saying something, and my picture looked sort of like me. But I heard no words coming out of either of our voices because all I could focus on was big yellow letters across my chest that said, Glenn Maxey, gay activist. And in a flash, I came out to all of America, and my 65-year-old mother who saw the news, and my grandmother who saw the news, Senator Mazzi, my employer. Senator Mazzi was about to run, go to the Supreme Court. I had over seven or eight job offers by state senators in the Capitol, and overnight, all those went away.
Wow.
Because all the liberal Democrats of the time told me to my face, I don't have a problem with you being gay, but I don't know how I would tell my constituents. This is 1986. And so I found myself with a year left with Senator Mazzi, with no job prospect, doing the stuff that I loved working in the legislature. So I called a bunch of gay activists. And people around the state will remember a lot of the names that were in that room, but there was I haven't had a lot of sleep here. Sue Lovell was there.
Sue Lovell's a Houston
former city councilwoman.
Person, former, yeah,
lesbian. Of course, all of your institutions here that have a name in front of them, Bill Nelson, Terry Thibodeau, a young woman who was very energetic and very ambitious at the time, and I thought, this woman is pushy. She was the head of the Houston Gay Political Caucus. Her name was Anise Parker. And so all of us got together. There were about 20 people in the room. At Bill, my friend Bill, God, name just had in my head. We wrote some bylaws, and we created the Lesbian Gay Rights Lobby to go to the legislature to work on the AIDS issue and repealing the homosexual conduct law, Section 2106 of the Penal Code, which is now unconstitutional and still on the books.
To this very day.
To this very day. I will die with that legislation still on the books.
With a tiny asterisk and italics that says it's
unconstitutional. I got a funny story. A great story to tell about that in just a second. Anyway, long story short, I had no job. We created this new organization, and people said, well, who is going to be our executive director and our lobbyist? Well, I'm not doing anything. So all of a sudden, I went from totally closeted to the chief homo of the state of Texas in about 3 months. Bam.
Number one queer.
And we still think of you that way.
And you know, I went to the legislature. I lobbied for, you know, a number of sessions at the height of the HIV and AIDS crisis. I have great stories about blackmailing legislators to get HIV funding and all kinds of great stuff. And just never thought that my career would go that way. My whole life, I had run for the legislature as back in 1982 in Bryan, College Station, Texas. I always wanted to serve in the legislature. And all of a sudden, I'm now working at the legislature as an openly gay person. When I ran for the legislature in 1982, when I lost that night, I said to myself, I'm never going to do public office again because I have to compromise on too many things that I core believe in, and I'll always be in the closet, you know. And I was, for me, it was almost time to come out of the closet. I wanted to do it, didn't know how. didn't know anybody around me who was LGBT. Just didn't know how to deal with all of that. So I found myself now, you know, the chief homo of the state. And a few years later, opportunity came to run for the legislature. And, you know, I met my dream of being in the legislature. My, you know, my whole being, that's what I wanted to do. It was my, the one thing on my bucket list was to serve in the Texas legislature. And what's, I like especially young people to hear today, that when I failed the first time and said, I can never do this because I am gay, a decade later, I took the oath of office from Ann Richards, and the only reason that I got to be a legislator was because I was out and open as a queer. Mm-hmm. I would have never gotten elected in Austin, Texas, if I had just been Glenn Maxey liberal. It was the being gay and being who I was what got me to where I needed to go.
What difference did that make, not to maybe, well, to some other Democrats who had previously said to you, you know, it doesn't bother me personally, but now here you are in the legislature as a colleague, not somebody working for one of their colleagues. You're one of their colleagues. What difference did that make? It had to have made a huge difference.
It makes a huge difference. You know, there's that old story that if you're not at the table, you're on the menu. We were on the menu a lot. And, you know,
and
when I got...
still are to some degree.
And we still are. But, you know, the fact that we were mostly on the menu when there was not a LGBT person in the legislature. When I was there, the bullshit stopped, you know, or at least people noticed it, and we had to deal with it. And quite frankly, there was not a negative anti-gay policy that passed while I was there. Not because I stopped it, but because I was there. And then we had a bunch of crap for about 8 years, but now Mary Gonzalez and Celia Israel, and hopefully in the coming years, a lot of more LGBT people will be in the legislature.
And there's several running this year.
Several running this year. Yeah, it's just a wonderful experience to see over, you know, my lifetime of 40 years in politics, the transition of our community, and live through all of that.
What's your 2106 story?
My 2106.
You said you had a wonderful story about 2106 not becoming unconstitutional.
Oh, for those people who, the Texas Democratic Party held a conference this last summer, Equality Forward conference for the Stonewall Democrats and LGBT Democrats across the state. And Mitch Kateen, he's somebody that I've known and who helped back in the days of the AIDS quarantine kinds of things, and helped me as a legislator. He's a lawyer in Houston. He was the lawyer for the guys who appealed the sodomy statute to the Supreme Court.
Gardner and Lawrence.
Thank you. Yep. Keep in mind, I have not slept, and I'm not pulling names up. So, Mr. Gardner and Lawrence. And as everybody knows, these were some just average Texans. These were not gay activists.
Not at all.
Not at all. Who were just caught up in a situation of the police arresting them, charging them with homosexual conduct, you know, embarrassing them by pulling them out of their house and to the police station in their underwear, basically. And, you know, they've become icons in gay rights history for agreeing to let us take that case forward. You know, I spent 10 years as a lobbyist for the community trying to find somebody who had been charged with homosexual conduct so they'd have standing to go to court.
I remember being in the Dallas Voice office when we heard this story, and we all went, this is it.
People would call the office and say, two lesbians have been arrested for having sex on the beach. And I would go, thank God, maybe they'll be the plaintiff. And then I'd find out that they would have been charged for lewd conduct. Mm-hmm. I said, would somebody charge somebody with sodomy so we can go to court?
Their story was the perfect storm.
It was perfect.
It really was. I mean, they were in their private home.
Well, and two, it was a false report, mm-hmm. That there was some sort of
domestic,
you know,
a fight.
Right.
And so the police came and, you know, came in.
There was an altercation with the police about whether they could come into the house, and got testy between the police and the guys, and so the police said, we're going to charge you with sodomy. So these guys, to make this story very short, said that they would be plaintiffs. And they went through all those courts, all the way up to the Court of Appeals, to the U.S. Supreme Court, had their private life just blown out there for committing homosexual sex. And so now they're both deceased. And at this conference, their attorney said, I can say this for the first time in history, they never had sex.
Wow.
They were charged with it. They were watching a football game in their underwear. And the police just charged them with that because, you know, they could charge faggots with whatever they wanted to, evidently. And so they never were guilty of the crime, even.
Wow.
And I think that is fascinating that those guys allow... they could have easily said, we didn't do it. I mean, and all along the way, judges said, we're going to throw this out. And they said, no.
Right.
We want to take it on to solve this problem for our community.
Right.
They are such heroes.
Mitchell Kateen, their attorney, said to me, and this was after Lawrence died last year, he said that the judge wanted to throw it out, and they had to convince the judge not to throw it out, to just accept their no contest plea.
Yeah, it's a fascinating story.
Wow. It is.
Because it was such a good story. It really was the perfect story. We saw that case come through, and we went, yes! Which is the...
And what's fascinating to me is that, I know we have to take breaks here, yeah. But what's fascinating to me is just this week, in fact, on Thursday, I guess, June 26th, 2014, was a double anniversary, because the Lawrence v. Texas ruling came on June 26th, 2003, and the Windsor decision came on June 26th, 2013. So I'm hoping... that on, and I think it should be our new pride. It's just 2 days away from the Stonewall Rebellion of 1969, which we celebrate every June, and we commemorate. And you know, if the next ruling that's going to strike down this Section 2 of DOMA,
Fink v. Texas,
could be Fink v. Texas. whatever that ruling is, I hope it lands on June 26th, and I think that should be our new Pride Day for June.
We need to take a break. You're listening to Lambda Weekly on 89.3 KNON FM. I'm Dave Taffet here in the studio with Ron Landis and the late Patty Fink. Our guest is former state representative Glenn Maxey. We'll be back with more right after this.
You feel petrified. You're struggling with your mortgage payments, not knowing what to do. You do nothing. But if you do something, you're far more likely to get the most positive outcome. Making Home Affordable is a free government program. Call 888-995-HOPE to talk one-on-one with a housing expert about your options. Call 888-995-HOPE or visit makinghomeaffordable.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Treasury, HUD, and the Ad Council.
You're listening to Lambda Weekly on 89.3 KNON FM. I'm Dave Taffet here in the studio with the late Patty Fink and Laron Landis. So you picked Glenn up at the hotel.
I did.
So that's the secret. That's the secret.
We
to
have
her,
to have her picking up people at hotels around the...
just have her picking up people, period.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So that's it.
And that
just
works.
Down on the street.
That's it. We
that's
just
point.
See a young woman on the street, pick her up, and come to work.
Yeah. That's it. Thank you, Glenn. You just solved our problem.
After... you know, 30 years on the air with you or whatever it is.
Yeah.
That's the secret.
That's the secret.
We're talking to Glenn Maxey. He is, of course, a right-wing Tea Party organizer. He's equated homosexuality with alcoholism. That was you, right?
That was not me.
That wasn't you. Oh, okay.
I equate homosexuality with mint juleps.
Now, as we said to one of our other favorite guests, Eddie Bernice Johnson, I said, so Rick Perry's a good friend of yours. The look on her face is just...
It was priceless.
It was priceless. The look of horror on her face. So Rick Perry and you actually were good friends in the legislature.
I came to work for Senator Mosley in 81, came back... to work around the Capitol throughout the 80s doing the lobby work for the community. And Rick Perry got elected in 1985.
As a Democrat.
As a Democrat, I remember the time sitting in the lobby at the in the gallery with the women lobbyists from Planned Parenthood and just different women's organizations, and me waiting for something to happen. You know, for, on the calendar, we're waiting around for meetings all the time, and we actually had a contest of who had the cutest buns. This is 1985, I believe, maybe 87. The cutest buns on the House floor. And I nominate Rick Perry, and he won.
Really?
Yeah. He had the tightest jeans and the, he had a package back then.
So what happened? He changed parties and he lost his package.
Yeah, he did. He did.
Okay, so you know him somewhat. I mean, you actually did work with him while you were a legislator.
Oh, yeah. I know him personally, yes.
What the hell was he talking about when he was equating homosexuality and alcoholism? Do you have any clue?
No, I just think he's pulling up the fact that he might be an alcoholic.
Or as Ellen DeGeneres and Rosie O'Donnell used to talk about, thespians.
Thespians.
Yes, they were thespians.
There you go.
Knowing him as well and as close as the two of you are, because after all you did write a book about him, is that man going to run for president again?
Who knows? I don't think any sane person would go to Iowa on a regular basis or go to right-wing organizations that help crown the Republican nominee if they weren't looking to do something. You know, I think the people of Texas are saying good riddance. I mean, even the Republicans in Texas. I see at the Republican convention 2 weeks ago, they had a straw poll of who you want to see as president, and he came in like fifth, you know, at the Texas Republican convention. So I think they've tired of him. And I worked with a lot of delusional candidates over my 40 years in politics, but if Rick Perry thinks he can win the Republican nomination and, God forbid, be a national nominee and thinks he can get elected president, he's delusional.
So let's say it's a matchup between him and, I don't know, Hillary. Don't you want to see those debates?
See that I hope he does run.
Now,
I hope he does run, and I hope he does get the nomination.
Few people in this room are young enough to sit and watch TV in 1972 when my good friend, and I loved him, George McGovern, was our nominee. He was a little bit too much to the left for the nation, and the whole map was solid red.
I lived in Albany, New York. We voted for him.
No, you didn't.
Albany,
no.
New York did.
Albany, New York.
Albany, New York did.
The only state was Massachusetts.
Yeah.
I predict if Rick Perry runs against Hillary Clinton, Rick Perry is going to be lucky if he has Idaho and Utah by the end of the night.
You heard it here first, folks. So you don't think the glasses are going to help him? He's trying all these things to cover up his big
right.
boobs.
No, well, the glasses are good.
But what do you have against Idaho and Utah?
I don't. I'm just thinking. I don't. I apologize to Idaho and Utah. Even y'all will probably go blue if Rick Perry's running.
I mean, Utah, just this week, the appeals court upheld the throwing out of their marriage law.
Huge news.
Yeah, our circuit court hasn't done that with ours yet. Well, so Utah is really a leader.
Mm-hmm. And it's important about Utah because that's a circuit court. Now we're all past all the district
right.
levels. We're at a circuit court. You know, we'll probably see in the next number of months circuit courts around the nation affirming the lower courts, and that will be great. You know, I hate to have to say it, but the best chance of a circuit court doing something stupid and saying there's a state's rights here or something is the fifth, where our
yes.
cases are going. And once again, in modern gay rights history, the major cases will that go to the Supreme Court and get decided will come out of the great state of Texas because, you know, get the wrong ruling and it gets appealed. In order for a case to get to the Supreme Court, we're going to have conflicting rulings in different districts. I mean, there is a situation that all go in our favor, and Mississippi's still sitting over there without a ruling yet. So getting conflicting rulings means it will be at the Supreme Court in the next term, and, you know, it'll all be done.
What I'm kind of curious about is all of the rulings have been really brilliant rulings talking about how these laws were created out of animus, that it's not equality, and one after the other, and each one has found a different way to say it. What's the Fifth Circuit going to say?
I don't know. Everywhere in history that I've been told was that you don't plagiarize other things. But evidently in the law, I'm not a lawyer, so I can say this. Evidently in the law, you can plagiarize other people. So every federal judge is plagiarizing the best lines from the judge before and then trying to find one better. You know, it is like a writing contest going on right now.
Probably instructing their clerks.
Clerks. Like, find me the one line that gets it further down the road. And I'm just fascinated by it. I have no idea. Just keep in mind the people who sit on the Fifth Court of Appeals that represent Texas, Arkansas, Louisiana. That Fifth Court's based out of New Orleans. They are not very progressive-minded people. And, you know, the way that works is that these kind of cases don't get assigned to the person who was appointed by Bill Clinton, the minority judges on those courts. So I have no idea what they're going to do. I don't know how they wiggle out around it. They're going to have to go right back into the 1800s and find some states' rights garbage and try to wiggle that.
It was interesting.
And not be embarrassed saying it in their ruling, and not be embarrassed by saying it.
And not be embarrassed by saying it.
With this 10th Circuit Court ruling, this was the first time that a judge in 16 rulings that we had a dissent. It wasn't unanimous.
That's true.
It was a 2-1 decision.
But it wasn't a full dissent. It was only he was partially upholding, and he upheld it only on one basis.
And he kind of used the states' rights issue, if you read it. But it was a dissent, though. So it's the first time. So that leaves the possibility that, you know, if this does go to the Supreme Court, which it will eventually, it's not just automatically we're going to win this.
I guess they could rule based on, like you said, states' rights, but they could also be talking about the right of a state. You know, that it's fine for the other states if that's what they're looking for, just not.
And that's kind of what he was saying.
Yeah.
That's kind of what
not necessarily in this state. What's interesting about that Utah ruling, though, is they ruled for Utah. They issued a stay for Utah. So clerks in Colorado have said, oh, well, we're in the Tenth Circuit, so that applies to us. But the stay only applies to Utah, so Boulder County and two other counties now are issuing marriage licenses in Colorado.
Go Colorado!
Yeah. Indiana also.
That's why you have a wedding brownie.
Indiana also had their marriage ban overturned at a district level. They issue marriage licenses
Hundreds of people got married in a couple of days.
Well,
now a
stay has been issued on that.
Yeah. Wow.
Real interesting what's going on there. But Texas is the one that's going to be real interesting just because...
Just to where we are.
And it's such a conservative court. And that's the one that will be at the Supreme Court.
Yeah. But the other thing they could do is hear the case and just let it drag on and drag on and not rule.
Exactly.
Right. Like the Texas Supreme Court is doing with the two marriage cases that they heard. I guess it's one case that consolidated the two cases.
It's all fascinating to me, and for those of us who, you know, were at the beginning, or not the total beginning, but early in this movement, when everything was
at the very
beginning,
Glenn.
When everything was so bleak and so uphill, what's happened in the last 2 years has just been phenomenal. I mean, it's just, you just have to sit back and almost cry. I have to say that when I was the first became the executive director of Lesbian Gay Rights Lobby, We were still, 6 months from a legislative session. And I really thought that my job was just clipping the newspaper because we were so excited when there was a positive story about gay rights. Mm-hmm. We didn't have the internet, so I didn't email anybody. I actually made copies at the copy center and would mail out to my board that the Dallas Morning News had a 2-inch story about some positive gay thing. I mean, it was a big deal. And so amazing I just reviewed and read a article from Joe Cutbirth, who was formerly a Fort Worth Star Telegram reporter, now is a teaching journalism at some university in the Northeast, just wrote a wonderful article about how we communicated as a LGBT community in the 70s and 80s in Texas, talking about This Week in Texas for those, Twit magazine. Everything was really through the bar rags, the magazines and things in the bars. There was nothing else. There were a few newsletters, but mostly it was, if you wanted to know what was happening, you went at 7 o'clock Fridays to a bar and picked up a gay bar magazine.
One thing that was so amazing about that was when Judge overturned 2106 Jerry Buckmeyer overturned the 2106 law. That actually happened in August. Now, in Dallas, we celebrate Pride in September as a commemoration of the anniversary of that. But it took from the end of August till the middle of September for us to get word out and hang enough posters on up and down Cedar Springs and get people over to Lee Park 3 blocks away for this big celebration. It took 3 weeks of planning. Now it would be what we do
we
is...
We can flash mob it now.
Well, what we do now is just we put it on the internet and we're meeting at the monument in 3 hours and 200 people show up.
Yeah, these kids today... those of us who had covered wagons and muskets on the frontier of the gay rights movement.
Even 1993, the March on Washington, we were planning that. We had three national meetings. One of them we had at the Gay and Lesbian Community Center here. Three national planning meetings took 2 years to get all those people to Washington.
When we did the March on Austin in 1989, when right after I became executive director of the lobby, the way we got that 30,000 people to the state capitol was a year in advance. We asked every gay organization in the state, churches, bicycle clubs, whatever they were, to have their annual meeting a year out to build the crowd, because we knew on our own we just could not communicate with enough people, or we couldn't just stand on bars and yell enough on Friday night to get the crowd there. It is such a different organizing tool today.
I was at that 89 march, and I remember feeling I'd never seen so many people like me ever. You know what I mean? I cried.
They were all late?
Now.
It was pretty phenomenal.
I was
scared
just like the first time.
The Jesus out of the legislature. Uh-huh. That was one of the more interesting things too. The lobby decided they had the first lobby day on the Monday after that march on a Sunday afternoon. And so 25,000 people. And the next day on the floor of the House, I had asked Representative Deborah Danberg from Montrose in Houston, and Representative Lena Guerrero from Austin, represented the district that I later won when she retired to be on the Railroad Commission, and Representative David Kane at the time, to do a resolution on the floor in memory of everybody who had died of HIV and honoring the caretakers who were in the middle of the epidemic. A memorial resolution in the Texas legislature is passed. There is an immediate motion made at the back mic that Deborah did. Mr. Speaker, I move to add all members' names to the resolution. First time in history that a member asks that their name be removed from the resolution. 59 members of the Texas House went to the chief clerk at the front and took their names off.
Wow.
And it was just...
out of 150.
Out of 150, more than a third, took their names off. More would have if they had gotten the message. You know, I was just blown away. We had no communications methodologies back then. It was just me. But the next morning, every newspaper in the state, Dallas Morning News at the time, which was still pretty conservative back then, Fort Worth newspaper, Houston, San Antonio, Austin, every newspaper had an editorial where they put in a box the names of those 59 legislators, and they put the word shame.
Wow.
I think in the Dallas Morning News even. And so I'm this, like, as a lobbyist, thinking, God, it's going to be tough to break through all of this. Now, a short year later, Glenn Maxey gets elected to the legislature. And if you've been taking a tour of the Capitol, you see those historic desks out there, and they have like the old school desk where you can open up the top and put things inside it.
And you can put glue in the tray and pull it and peel it up. You know, people did that in second grade too. Right?
Yeah. So I opened mine up and I blew up a poster with the 59 names who had taken their names off, put it inside my desk, and every day that I walked to the floor, I did two things. I reach inside my desk and I plant on the front of my desk the American flag, the Texas flag, and the rainbow flag.
Wow.
Flew on my desk every year for 12 years that I sat in a chair. And I typically always try to put it on the desk so it stayed through the weekend so the tourists could see it. And it was really fun to watch. You know, we're out of session, I'd be walking, and I would see tourists saying, that's where the gay guy sits. And young gay men and lesbians talking about me. They didn't know who I was, but I'd be hearing, that's where the gay guy. And that's the whole role about what it means to be not just a leader, but be the sort of the icon that people can say, I too can do whatever my dreams might be. And so I was really that the most important thing I did in the legislature was just being there. But I took that list in the desk, and every day I took the next name on the list. And I would go and I would sit down next to that redneck, since almost we're all rednecks, and I would chat about their family, you know, your kids, you know, what do you do for a living? What's your community all about? Let me tell you a little bit about me. You know, now I spent a little bit of time at the beginning of my process at the legislature, just talking about me as a single guy, you know, and I realized that my internalized homophobia of not just sort of putting it out there. People would say, what did you do on the weekend? And I would not say, me and a bunch of friends, we went to a bar and we had a big party and I went to Gay Rights March or whatever. I just say, we had a nice weekend. I wouldn't even talk about it. And I look back on it and think how bad that was that I was internalized. Now, it wasn't until... maybe I shouldn't tell this on the air. I can't tell the story. But there were a couple of women legislators who were fairly successful. And they encouraged me when I said, what do y'all do to sort of get bills out of committee and all of that? And they actually said, they said something very explicit about what they promised other legislators. They basically said, we just promise some blowjobs. And I went, what?
Wow.
And one of them said, you know, that might work for you too. and that was the time I realized I got to be funny. I got to use the gay humor, you know. Mm-hmm. And then just right after the Queen of England came, and it was a big pomp and ceremony. We had to be on the floor at 9:00. And sit on that floor, all of us and all the guests. It was like a, you know, cattle car, waiting for the Queen of England to show up. That woman came in. She walked to the podium. She went, hi, and she left. She was there maybe 15 seconds. And everybody was going like, what the hell? We sat here for 3 hours, and all she did is wave at us and walk right through the room. And that's when I stood up and said, the next time that you want to have a party, you need to get a real queen to throw it. And I'll organize it. And people started laughing with me. And when they made the vulgar jokes that happen in that kind of place, I told a gay joke. And I became a real human being. And I realized when people said, what did you do on the weekend? I said, I had a fabulous time. This is, you know, that's when it started breaking down, when we become be totally open and out and happy and gay.
Okay. We need to take one more break. You're listening to Lambda Weekly on 89.3 KNON FM.
You are listening to KNON 89.3 FM in Dallas and Fort Worth, the voice of the people.
KNON is a community radio station that has survived on listener support for over 30 years. If you would like to donate at KNON anytime, you can do so by going to KNON.org and clicking on Pledge Now. We appreciate your support and thank you for listening to Dallas's original community radio station, KNON 89.3 FM, the voice of the people.
Hi, I'm Cleve Jones, and you're listening to Lambda Weekly on 89.3 KNON FM.
And this is Lambda Weekly on 89.3 KNON FM. I'm Dave Taffet here in the studio with Laurent Landis and the late Patty Fink. Patty, you were at the convention this weekend.
Oh, yeah. And as many, many people in Dallas were. And, of course, it's Flair City. You know, you get to, you know, get your cash and do what I call Main Street and Second Avenue and shop. But great fun, great speakers, great camaraderie, great spirit coming out of there as we prepare to go into November. And, of course, we have all of our nominees, and what a great ticket. And I was just talking in the break about I ran into former mayor, Dallas Mayor Laura Miller, and we were talking about the caliber of candidates that we have going forward. And it's really exciting. It's really exciting. When you look at the top of the ticket, all the way down, I mean, everybody is experienced, they're seasoned, they know what they're doing, they're qualified, they're beyond qualified. This is an exciting time to be a Democrat in Texas. And conventions bring that out. They really, really do.
Do you know who surprised me? I saw him just briefly, was Sam Houston. Very funny guy. He was talking about how, you know that statue down on I-45? He said, people always ask me, you don't look like that statue. He said, no, I'm a lot better looking than that.
Sam Houston's going to be our next Attorney General. And that's important for LGBT people because we will continue to have people
On a better name in this state.
Yes. You know, I wanted to say just a little bit about the Democratic Party and LGBT issues. This was my 22nd state convention. They happen every 2 years.
Wow.
I went to my first one in 1972, which was the McGovern-Humphrey Wallace fight for presidential nominations as a closeted man. And I ended up sitting in my delegation from Sam Houston State, a kid that we had elected. And he came to the floor with a T-shirt on that said, I'm gay. And
wow.
I thought, oh, my God, he's brave. And I wasn't. And as we went through the next few years, I met icons of the Democratic Party history of LGBT folks. I made friendships with Louise Young and Al Calkin and Anise Parker and Sue Lovell and Betty Naylor and all those folks. But I was still closeted. And the first conventions that I went to, there was always a gay caucus, and they were in somebody's hotel room. And there would be 15 or 20 people, and they would come, and they would have their gay button on. Not many lesbian buttons then. It was gay.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody else was given a button that may just have, like, an X on it. Or it would say, surprise, or whatever. It had no meaning, but that's how you knew who were the closet cases walking around the floor. So I always, every convention in the early 70s, I would go and get my closet case button and, you know, walk around. By 1976, at the national convention, our gay delegates went on the floor to have a picture made. And I asked, can I go with y'all? I went to the gay caucus at the national convention as a closet case. You know, just in the shadows. And as we were walking there, Louise Young said to me, "You just got to get over it." You know? Okay, that was 76. As in those days, the whole thing was to get the Democratic Party to pass a resolution to repeal the homosexual conduct statute. And we fought about it. We got a hearing, and then a couple of years later, we got it out of committee. But it got lost on the podium. It got lost on the podium for a number of years, almost a decade. It never could be voted on. And it was not until, I think, almost 1980, we finally got it to the floor, and we passed that resolution. It was huge.
That is huge.
And more gay folks would be coming. More and more people had on the buttons. Somewhere along the way, probably in the late 80s, we stopped doing the closet case buttons. You either had to get your ass out of the closet or you couldn't walk around with us. But I want to jump forward that as over the years we, you know, got more kinds of things in our platform to supporting the LGBTQ community. In 2012, under the leadership of our new chair, Gilberto Hinojosa, he pushed to put not the LGBT community, but the chairman pushed the convention to put marriage equality in our platform, the first southern state to do so. And yesterday, the Texas Democratic Party passed a platform that includes marriage equality, support for the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, support for issues around gay and lesbian bullying and issues
security.
Around security, and for the first time in history, and probably one of the first states in the nation, we have put in our platform support for issues that will help transgendered Texans have a full equality life. We have a full section on adoption, non-discrimination adoption based on sexual orientation and gender identity, allowing transgender people to have a process to be able to change their identity documents to match their gender. And I'm really proud of that. And what's the most important point, those things came from transgender persons through this process, and there was not a single negative vote statement or vote against having every issue the LGBTQ community asked to be in the Democratic Party platform is there. And if we had given more, we would have had more. There was no opposition to our issues in the Democratic Party. And anybody, and y'all might be nonprofit, but I'm going to say it here, anybody who will support a party like the Republican Party that says we need to be fixed through reparative therapy and puts that negative stuff in their platform, if you vote for that party, you don't deserve to be part of our community because you are not part of the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender community. The Democratic Party has come full circle, 100% with us, and you got to vote for us. We need people who will move this platform into state law, and that would be that whole Democratic ticket, Wendy Davis and Letitia Van De Putte, and having an attorney general that will fight when we have to take things through the court system. And that's my message for today. I've been doing this for a long time. I've seen lots of people get even killed during this struggle. And by God, people can at least take time to go vote.
Where it does make a difference, really, is the attorney general. First, you know, we think of the governor as the person on top, but moving it through the legislature, that would be the lieutenant governor. But the attorney general, look what happened in a couple of states like Oregon, where the attorney general said, this law is indefensible, and I'm just not going to put up a fight against getting rid of the marriage law. And so they didn't argue it, and they adopted what the court told them to do. Here, Greg Abbott fought a couple of divorces. He's against marriage. But when people want to dissolve their marriages, he's against that, too.
Because it would require him to acknowledge that a marriage was there to dissolve. And he doesn't want to do that. You know, he's gone out of his way and spending taxpayer dollars to... And look at the party. I just think what you said was just now, Glenn, was so poignant. Because look at the other party that went to court to prevent a group of gay Republicans from having a six-foot table. went to court.
Well, you know,
I mean, and so there is no comparison. There is no comparison.
I walked by the Stonewall table. It was 6 feet, but there were people around it. It was very frightening. look at what that table did.
And I know that the Democrats have reached out to those GOBT Republicans and say, you know, come join us. At least, you know, come to our convention. What has been the response from them?
I heard it was thanks but no thanks was their response.
Do you know, I spoke to Jeff Davis, who's the head of Log Cabin in Texas, and his point was, you know, he appreciates it, and he did. But what he really felt was Republicans in the party are then going to say, you see, you really are a Democrat, and so you really do have to stay away. And his point is to change the attitude in the party. I mean, I know everybody here is looking at me like, that's not going to happen.
You know, but in East Texas, well, almost all of Texas, but especially in East Texas, that we have a sign for a statement when somebody says something like that, and you just say, God bless him.
Bless his heart.
Yeah. Bless his heart.
Yeah, bless her heart.
And if you go on Twitter and even on Facebook and you see the hash, don't need fixin', that is everywhere, because we've been talking about the fact that we don't need fixin'. And I loved a line from the convention from Joaquin Castro, who's the congressman, not the mayor, as was heard last many days. Congressman, not the mayor.
Housing secretary.
The mayor.
Labor secretary. Labor? What
no,
was
that? Would be what the,
was, that would be the mayor.
The mayor is the.
Julian was just nominated to be what?
HUD housing. Secretary.
HUD secretary.
HUD secretary. Yeah.
But Joaquin Castro said, we need to be fixing schools, not gay people. He said that from the podium. So, you know, that's been a kind of the attitude within the party, too. And when you mentioned, Glenn, that there was no opposition to bringing stuff into the platform, I would go a step beyond and say it was well supported. It was welcomed wholeheartedly. And it was just the sense on the floor from all of the delegates, whether they were LGBT or not, that we were all on the same page. We were all about being accepting of each other and supportive of our families and our rights. And that's you can't just write that down. I mean, that's a feeling that you just carry forward, and you know it's true.
One of the things the party did was, for all the caucuses, like the Jewish caucus and the women's caucus, well, the women's caucus also met on the main floor, but the Muslim caucus and there were so many different caucuses.
There was a small gun owners caucus.
They all met in small rooms. The LGBT caucus, they gave the main convention center floor to, and it was packed.
There was not a room big enough anywhere but going to the convention center floor.
And we had Wendy Davis. We had Letitia Van De Put. We had all of the major candidates came and spoke with us and encouraged us to get out there and you know, help them win. And I would say they were probably, even early days, didn't have a lot of candidates coming to speak to the to the lesbian gay caucus.
That's the last place they were going to be seen. There was an excuse.
Except for Harriet Earhart and Deborah Danberg. They'd show up. But I do want to get back to your book. You wrote a book several years ago that you were on our show promoting when we were on Mornings. And that was
it
about,
can still be purchased on Amazon.com.
It is still there.
Very entertaining
book, by the
way. It's
still timely.
Now, after the book came out, and this is something I've been meaning to ask you for a while, after the book came out, did you hear from more people?
When there was an announcement that the book came out and it hit just the media the first day, I had three guys that day.
We have to say what the book is about.
Okay. Well, yeah, we sort of missed that.
Yeah.
The book is called Head Figurehead, The Search for the Private Life of Rick Perry. And
who you know personally.
Who I know personally. And I chronicled over his time in Austin, his dalliance, to put it mildly, with the Friends of Dorothy. And
men of the same gender.
I told about 12 different men that I know or I learned about. There was the Huffington Post online news organization was doing a story about his hypocrisy of being so anti-gay while perhaps participating in homosexual conduct. And I didn't know whether it was true or not. The reporter called me. I said, Well, you know, I've never really delved into this, but I was retired at the time, not doing much. And I said, let me ask around, you know. And after about 6 weeks of research, I had the editor of the Huffington Post say to me, you are one of the best amateur investigative reporters we've ever worked with. I said, I'm not a reporter. I'm a gay gossip queen. And it was fascinating research using the internet and Facebook. I actually sent maybe 500 emails to just gay people that I know saying, what have you heard? And I got back all of the stories, lots of the stories totally conflagrated. People over cocktails had made up stuff, but I was able to pick it apart. You know, people would say, well, I don't really know, but it was a friend of John. And then I would say, I'd go to John's Facebook page and see who his friends were and see who his friends were that I knew. And I would ask his friends, did John ever tell you about Rick Perry? And it was like a puzzle. So since the book came out, I met 28 gentlemen.
Wow. Who've
had the pleasure.
So is there a sequel coming out?
You know, I don't know.
If he runs for office, it's obvious.
Yeah. Let's put it this way. Glenn Maxey will not have to write a book. There is enough, let's just say, seeds. If Rick Perry wants to water that by running for president, it will all be out. I still, you know, the story has a main character of a young man who was a gay hustler, a male prostitute, mm-hmm. and he's still in my phone.
Glenn, we are out of time. It's been a lot of fun. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Glenn.
Always good to see you. Whenever you're up in Dallas, let us know. Happy to have you on. You're listening to Lambda Weekly on 89.3 KNON-FM. The Ethiopian show is up after us, and stay tuned for that.
Thanks, Glenn.